Okay, Erev Tov. We continue tonight with the series The Present of the Jews, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yona ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Tonight we're discussing the 17th and 18th presidents, Andrew Johnson and Ulysses S. Grant. Before we get to that, one correction. I try to be as accurate as possible. I mentioned last time that the only president who has a name from the Chumash is Abraham Lincoln. I just ran through a list in my head and I overlooked, someone said to me afterwards, Benjamin Harrison, Binyamin Harrison, as we like to call him, whom we'll be discussing in 2 weeks, but okay. America was shocked by the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, and it underscored that the Civil War was not yet over. So Lee, 5 days before the assassination, had surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia at the Appomattox Courthouse, but fighting carried on with other generals and other battles further south for almost 2 more months. And Lee said he could have no control over what other generals were doing. Then the fighting ended, but not the rancor, not the bitterness, certainly not the new world that had dawned in the South that featured freedom for millions of black slaves, the millions of black slaves that had made the Southern economy hum, and that had defined the social and cultural life of the South for at least 2 centuries, or a century and a half maybe. It would also not be easy to reabsorb the South into the Union. Lincoln had plans for what was called Reconstruction, literally rebuilding the Union. But those plans went awry after Lincoln was murdered by a Southerner, and the factions and the infighting that occurred thereafter ensured that nothing would go smoothly. Lincoln favored compassion and reconciliation, as we heard last time from the second inaugural, with malice towards none, with charity towards all, while his successor was not as eloquent nor as benevolent. Now, before we leave Lincoln, it bears mentioning one of the great uncanny ironies of American history, the connections between Lincoln and John Kennedy. Lincoln was elected to Congress in 1846, Kennedy in 1946. Lincoln was elected president in 1860, Kennedy in 1960. Both were assassinated by Southerners. Oswald, who was born in 1839, I'm sorry, Booth killed Lincoln. Booth was born in 1839, Oswald was born in 1939. Booth ran from a theater and was caught in a warehouse. Oswald ran from a warehouse and was caught in a theater. Both Lincoln and Kennedy were shot in the head on Fridays. Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy, and Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln, Evelyn Lincoln. Kennedy was succeeded by a Southerner born in 1908, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Lincoln was succeeded by a Southerner also named Johnson, who was born in 1808. Both died young, Kennedy at 46 and Lincoln at 56. What does it all mean? Nothing. Except that Lincoln assumed office under the worst possible conditions one can imagine, with little support and even more modest talents. The best one can say of him is that for the most part he meant well, but not only was he no Lincoln, everyone knew he was no Lincoln, and Lincoln became even more beloved after he died. Now, Johnson himself was also spared assassination by a fluke, his designated murder. Remember that Booth was in a conspiracy with a number of others to kill Lincoln, Johnson, Seward, Stanton. And,
thank you. I'll give you a second.
Business. Johnson's designated murderer was a German Jew named George Atzerodt. And Atzerodt had even rented a room right above Johnson's room. Johnson, as the vice president, was just renting a room in a boarding house in Washington. And Atzerodt rented him right above to give him easy access to Johnson, but the night of the assassinations, he got cold feet, and instead he went to a bar and got drunk. Atzeret was arrested anyway and confessed. Now every person who had conspired with Booth was either dead or executed by July 7th, 1865, less than 3 months after the crimes. Booth was shot and killed by the authorities, but the ones who were arrested were tried, convicted, sentenced, their appeals were denied, and they're all hanged within 3 months of the assassination. There is something to be said for speedy justice. Such a thing would take at least a decade today, if not longer. Johnson was one of the most unlikely presidents ever. He had no formal education. He had no formal religion. He was functionally illiterate until he married a 17-year-old girl. He was 19. The 17-year-old girl taught him to read. But he always struggled with grammar and spelling. And the contrast with the autodidactic Lincoln was jarring. He was also short and stocky, he was 5'8", to Lincoln's tall and gaunt. Johnson was born in North Carolina in 1808. His parents ran a tavern, and Johnson was a drinker his whole life. In fact, his first address in Congress, the day he was sworn in as vice president, March 4th, 1861, he was sloshed, inebriated, rambling, and incoherent. Some blame it on the whiskey, some blame it on a fever that was exacerbated by the whiskey. Lincoln, sitting in the audience, listened and covered his head in humiliation. The speech was cut short, Johnson was hastily sworn in, and Lincoln never spoke to him again until, sheer coincidence, the morning of April 14th, 1865. And he spent time, he had told others in the interim, that he knows that Johnson is not a drunkard. He just had a bad day. Late that night, alone in his hotel room, Johnson heard the banging on his door, and a friend informed him that Lincoln had been shot. The next day, Johnson was sworn in as president, although it took him 2 months to move into the White House, as Mary Todd Lincoln refused to leave and even hinted that she thought Johnson was part of the conspiracy to murder her husband. So how did this individual, lambasted by the media of his time as a drunken clown, get to be president? Well, a young Andrew Johnson fled to South Carolina after some hooliganism. He had to flee the police. And he became an apprentice tailor, and then a tailor himself. Within a few years, he and his wife moved to Tennessee, where he set up a tailoring shop, and he became an excellent tailor. Professional, his whole life he sewed. And then he got involved in local politics as well, moved up the ranks. He won some elections. He lost some elections. He was a man of principle, but quite stubborn. He found it very hard to compromise, and he spent his entire life with a chip on his shoulder against wealthy people, against those he called elitists, all a result of the inferiority complex he had and his humble origins. In the late 1850s, he became governor and then the senator from Tennessee, and he made his mark as the only Southern senator to oppose secession. And of course, that's what eventually led to his being nominated for vice president. He supported slavery. He owned a family of four slaves himself. He was a bit of a racist too, but he was adamantly opposed to dismantling the Union over slavery. So he opposed secession, and he became the only Southerner to remain in the U.S. Congress after his state seceded and joined the Confederacy. I mean, the Tennessee was part of the Confederacy, but he remained in Congress as their senator. Naturally, he endured a number of death threats throughout from his fellow citizens, and his courage in defying his peers was lauded. He even occasionally went back to Tennessee during the war, notwithstanding they're on the other side. He was vindictive also. He possessed the primitive's hatred of Jews. He once lambasted Florida Senator David Levy Yulee for supporting secession, calling him that contemptible little Jew. It didn't register that Yulee was not only intermarried, but he actually converted to Christianity. So what? He also disparaged Judah Benjamin as he said of him, there's another Jew, that miserable Benjamin, who sold out his country for a new one, and I quote, would sell out the new if he could in doing so make 2 or 3 million. All right, typical stereotype. As a legislator, he did not have much to commend himself, but Lincoln admired courage, and Johnson had courage, and he realized that having a Southerner and a Democrat, Johnson was not a Republican, he was a Democrat, on the ticket in 1864 could not only benefit him, but benefit the nation after the war ended. But of course, adding to Johnson's problems and lack of support was that he was a Democrat, not a Republican. After he became president, he ran smack into the buzzsaw of all the factions and personalities vying for power, influence, and even revenge. They all respected Lincoln. Lincoln to them was a towering figure, a gadol. No one respected Johnson, and therefore they all thought that if they got to him quickly and heavy-handedly, he would become their person. So you had different groups. You had the radical Republicans, led by Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. He was the one who was famous for being beaten unconscious with a cane on the Senate floor by a Southerner. The radicals thought Lincoln was too soft. They wanted the Confederate leaders tried for treason. They wanted guarantees that the Southern state would be loyal to the Union. And as proof they had changed, they wanted civil and political rights for all blacks. They were tired of Lincoln's conciliation and moderation and hoped to move Johnson their way. The moderate Republicans were more numerous in Congress. Among them was James Garfield, we'll talk about next week. Their focus was keeping the secessionist leaders out of power. They favored civil rights for the blacks, but not necessarily voting rights. The conservative Republicans were barely represented in Congress, but were in the cabinet. They just wanted to safeguard the gains they had made, preserving the Union and ending slavery. The future would be the future being what's the fate of the blacks in the South, what will be their rights, etc. That's not to be dealt with now. It's too divisive. Their leader was Secretary of State Seward, who, among other things, during the Johnson administration, would purchase the Alaskan territory for the United States from Russia for $7 million in gold. Turned out to be a good deal. Now, these three groups vied for influence with Johnson, who was a Democrat, and it was never easy. We hear a lot today about exit strategies after fighting a war. So Johnson had the rudiments of one, but it was not fully formed and certainly not ready to implement when Lincoln was... I mean, Lincoln had the rudiments of one, but it was not fully formed, not ready to be implemented when he was killed. Each of these three groups found something to like in Andrew Johnson. He saw the Southern leaders as traitors, just like they did, but also something to dislike. And the people in the South always saw Johnson as a renegade and a traitor because he had abandoned them before the war. And yet Johnson said as president, "This is a country for white men. And by God, as long as I am president, it shall be a government for white men." They could see how that would offend both blacks and the radical Republicans. He later added to a black audience, if it's found that the two races, white and black, cannot get along together, they would be, I quote, gathered together in a country and clime suited to you, meaning we'll find a place on the planet where you can live. Many things were in the mix to bring about this reconstruction. Loyalty oaths were required for those who wanted to become active in the Union. There were amnesty requests for secessionists. There was the enormous debt that the Confederacy owed at the end of the war. They'd borrowed millions from locals. They issued bonds. Obviously, when they surrendered, the bonds became worthless, and many wealthy Southerners who owned the bonds, wealthy Southerners, became impoverished overnight, and that affected the reconciliation as well. Cotton production, without slaves, and with the loss of many plantations, plummeted during the war and wouldn't reach pre-war levels until the 1870s. Now, Lincoln had suggested that southern states can rejoin the Union once 10% of the population take the loyalty oath, 10%, which was a risibly low figure to many Republicans. And Johnson ticked off a lot of people by announcing his Reconstruction plan at the end of May 1865, a little over a month after he took office, and not consulting Congress. Then Congress didn't even show up in Washington until December, and they only worked 3 months. His main objective was to bring the South back into the Union, and then the states could determine who can or can't vote. To many Northerners, this was a sellout, as was Johnson's amnesty proclamation. He reached out to his fellow Democrats, tried to buy off some Republicans, but it didn't go well. It didn't go well, not only because the offer was grudging, but also because the South was not fully on board. Many rebels just regretted the defeat, not the rebellion. Even if slavery was now illegal, that didn't cure them of their belief in black inferiority. They may have lost, but that didn't mean they loved the Union. Eventually, Johnson broke with the radical Republicans, and that led almost inexorably to the very first impeachment of an American president. There's only been two, the second being Bill Clinton. Now, the predicate was Johnson's dismissal of the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, who was a radical Republican, in 1867. Congress, a year early, had passed what they called the Tenure in Office Act, which was passed just to weaken Johnson and really embarrass him as president. It said the president could not fire an official without congressional approval. So we know a cabinet officer has to be approved by Congress, but the president can fire them. The Tenure in Office Act mandated the president get Congress's permission to fire a cabinet official as well. Well, Stanton was suspended while Congress was not in session. Johnson wanted to replace him with Ulysses S. Grant, who actually became the acting Secretary of War. When Congress returned, Stanton was restored to office. Johnson tried to fire him again. It didn't take, but nonetheless, he was impeached, means indicted by the House for refusing to adhere to it. There are 10 articles of impeachment against Johnson. The 10th, making 3 speeches to the nation in which he was disrespectful to Congress. By that standard, Obama could be impeached every week. Now, Johnson was tried by the Senate in the spring of 1868, which is also very strange. It's an election year. He had only a few months left anyway, but you see how much they hated him. He escaped conviction by 1 vote. 35-19 voted to convict. 36 would have given the Senate the 2/3 necessary to convict. Just by contrast, Clinton wasn't even close because all the Democrats voted for him, bar none. So therefore, he was found not guilty in each count. I think it was 55-45 or something along those lines. It wasn't even close to conviction. 20 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Tenure in Office Act was unconstitutional, and Johnson felt vindicated, but he burned all his bridges. He stood no chance of being nominated for president later that year. In May, during the Senate trial, the Republicans nominated the Civil War hero Grant as their presidential candidate. In 1875, Johnson was elected to the U.S. Senate, again from Tennessee, and again as a Democrat, the only president ever to become a senator after serving as president. That, too, he took as vindication, but he had no time to enjoy it before he actually showed up. He died in July 1875. The one positive interaction that Andrew Johnson had with Jews seems to have been a speech that he made in 1874 at the dedication of the Vine Street Temple in Nashville, Tennessee, saying that the temple should, I quote, ever remain a monument to the industry, prosperity, and welfare of the Jewish citizens of Nashville. All right, give him credit for that. But both in background and temperament, he had little involvement or interest in Jews, and in that he really was Lincoln's antithesis. But not so Grant. Ulysses S. Grant, rarely as a president, taken office with greater expectations of success than Ulysses Grant, and rarely has a president so disappointed. It's different today. Today, you know, we have very low expectations, and the presidents failed to achieve even those. But Grant was the Civil War hero. Grant was the general that the venerated Lincoln trusted above all others. And so Grant was perceived as the person who could heal the nation's wounds, implement the reasonable reconstruction plan that would unite and not divide. He was not successful. Perhaps because expectations were too high, too unrealistic. Perhaps because he did not possess the right tools to accomplish those goals. Let's see. Grant was born in Ohio in 1822 as Hiram Ulysses Grant. He never used the name Hiram, and a registration mistake at West Point led them to put his mother's maiden name, Simpson, as his middle name, and he liked that better. He became Ulysses Simpson Grant. He was the first president born in Ohio, but oddly, six of the next 11 presidents would be Ohioans, and none since Warren Harding. Memo to John Kasich. Now, Grant had a difficult childhood, not because his family was poor, they weren't, but they were tough. Tough parents. He had a very tough father who used to call him useless. Get it? Useless, Ulysses. And he spent a lifetime trying to please his father to no avail. And Grant was exceptionally average. Average build, average intelligence, average temperament. At West Point, he graduated 21st out of 39. Right in the middle. And he began his military career not as a cavalryman as he wanted, he was an experienced horseman, but in the quartermaster corps. Now, Grant's father, Jesse, was an opponent of slavery, and surely that influenced Ulysses as well. Grant served with distinction in the Mexican Wars, his first war, mainly under the command of Winfield Scott, but he was a junior officer. When the war ended, he married his wife, Julia, after an engagement that had lasted 4 years. We wouldn't tolerate four-year engagements anymore today. But, you know, Lubavitcher Rebbe was engaged, I think, for 5 years before he actually married, which is different parts of Europe. Grant and his wife had met while he was assigned to Missouri. She reeled him in. He actually came to see her sister socially. But that didn't work out, and Julia set her eyes on her. And Grant was smitten also. Julia was tough, athletic, stocky, and cross-eyed. It's reported she sometimes walked sideways in the White House to avoid crashing into people or things. But they had a beautiful life together. It was a real love story. Four children, including one daughter, Nellie, who married in the White House, and the couple was rarely apart, even during the Civil War. He would schlep her along to the battlefields. Grant, as I mentioned last time, was a known drinker to excess. And after he left the military in 1854, he was unsuccessful in civilian life. He became a farmer, could not make a living. In 1860, he opened up a leather goods shop, which he co-owned very hard. The family struggled. He had acquired one slave from his father-in-law, but Ulysses Grant came back to active life, really to life itself, when the Civil War broke out. He was out of the military, but he responded to Lincoln's call for volunteers, and he formed the militia in Illinois, where he was living. He was rebuffed by George McClellan when he sought a formal commission because of the persistent reports that he had left the army originally to avoid court-martial from being drunk on duty. Nonetheless, he was a terrific fighter. He won a promotion to colonel and then brigadier general. He was assigned to the Missouri area, and he was very aggressive as a general, winning several battles, never reluctant to take the war to the Confederacy. Grant was a student of war, and especially of military tactics, of strategy. And it's very famous, he would overlook the battlefield smoking a cigar, he's an inveterate cigar smoker, and personally direct his forces where to go. And he had an unvarnished view of war that made him successful. To Grant, war means to kill as many of the enemy as possible, or frighten them enough so they flee. That's how he saw war, not to achieve this end or that hill or this terrain. It was to kill as many of the enemy as possible. And the truth is, not every general looks at war that way. So he would occasionally suffer heavy casualties, but he pressed on. He was always very confident in battle. When things were going poorly, they said of Grant, he acted as if this is exactly how expected them to go, and he plodded on. And all this brought him to Lincoln's attention. Grant was taken by surprise at the Battle of Shiloh, and although he eventually rebuffed the rebels, his forces suffered heavy casualties. So Lincoln was urged to fire him, and Lincoln refused, saying, "I can't spare this man. He fights," as opposed to some of his other generals, including McClellan. Last time I told the famous vignette of Grant, say it again, because now it's Grant's turn. The Temperance Union came to urge Lincoln to fire Grant because he was a known heavy drinker, and Grant was winning all these battles, and Grant said to them, "Find out what he's drinking, and I'll send a barrel of it to each of my generals." That's how Lincoln saw the war. War was about victory. It was about prevailing in battle. The Battle of Vicksburg, which Grant fought, won the Union control over the Mississippi River, and Grant in charge of a large swath of territory, including much of Tennessee, Kentucky, and Mississippi. And this led to the most infamous act of Grant's career. We touched on briefly last time what he would spend 2 decades trying to live down. And that's General Order Number 11. So in December 1862, Grant became aware of the prevalence of black marketeers in his district, people smuggling southern cotton and other goods, which served, among other things, to prop up the southern economy that was being boycotted and whittled down. They were not only selling to civilians, but also to his own soldiers, and many of the peddlers were Jews. So Grant first dispatched a telegram to his headquarters telling them not to allow anyone to come south of Jackson, adding, I quote, "the Israelites especially should be kept out," end quote. And there are others as well, but undoubtedly Grant was influenced by the crude stereotype of his day that Jews were greedy materialists. Chas v'shalom. Chas v'shalom. Years later, an aide to Grant claimed that Grant's father, Jesse, who was always struggling to make a buck, had brought a Jew trader with him attempting to get his son to give the Jew and his father a permit, and Grant angrily threw them both out. Rather than take vengeance on his father, he took vengeance on Jews. Whatever the veracity of that story, the reality is that Grant issued General Order Number 11, which doesn't sound good, stating, "The Jews, as a class violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders, are hereby expelled from this department," it means the territory, "within 24 hours from the receipt of this order. Post commanders will see to it that all of this class of people be furnished passes and required to leave, and only one returning after such notification will be arrested and held in confinement until an opportunity occurs of sending them out as prisoners, unless furnished with permits from headquarters. No passes will be given to these people," that means us, "to visit headquarters for the purpose of making personal application of trade permits." Some justify the order, saying that the territory had been overrun by Jews and Yankees, and Grant explained in a letter, which really made it worse from his perspective, "The Jews seem to be a privileged class that can travel anywhere. They will land at any woodyard or landing on the river and make their way through the country. If not permitted to buy cotton themselves, they will act as agents for someone else who will be at a military post with a treasury permit to receive cotton and pay for it in treasury notes, which the Jew will buy up at an agreed rate, paying gold." So Grant suggested that the army take over the sale of cotton. But despite the reference to Jews and Yankees, it was always the Jews who were banished, and not just the traders. And that was part of Grant's overreach here. Several thousand Jews were affected by the order, including some of Grant's own soldiers, who as Jews would now be banned from that territory. The Jews from Paducah, Kentucky, were given 24 hours to leave, and they did. The Jews of Oxford, Mississippi, were also expelled. Ironically, it's exactly 100 years later that the government officials in Oxford tried to prevent James Meredith, the black, from entering University of Mississippi, exactly a century later. Other Jews in the district were now arrested or roughed up, because Jews became literally second-class citizens. But the order issued December 17th, 1862, was not long in force. As soon as it became known, Jews protested to Lincoln. Jews from Paducah sent a telegram to Lincoln that the order is, I quote, the grossest violation of the Constitution and our rights as good citizens under it. And they added that they're insulted and outraged by the order. Other Jewish groups also protested. Democrats in Congress protested and introduced a motion to censure Grant that passed overwhelmingly. One Jewish officer serving under Grant in Tennessee, in fact, resigned. Lincoln was appalled, and Grant's order was immediately revoked January 3rd, 1863, just 2 weeks after it was issued and 2 days after the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. Lincoln did not object, apparently, to banning illegal traders, but not to single out one race. And he said to Isaac Meir Wise, that Reform rabbi came to visit him 3 days later, to condemn a class is, to say the least, to wrong the bad with the good. By the way, Julia Grant was also appalled, and she always referred to Grant's deed as that obnoxious order. That episode would play a role in the future, as Grant would apologize repeatedly and profusely. Not every Jew would accept it. He would try to explain it away. So in the campaign of 1868, the Democrats brought up this order in the hopes of influencing the Jewish vote, and it became an issue. Isaac Meir Wise, a Democrat, of course, opposed Grant and could not understand how any Jew could vote for him, saying, "It is as if we have two selves, one a citizen of the state of Ohio and the other who is a Jew. But we have only one self, and no Jew should vote for Grant. For good measure," he added, a little slight exaggeration, "no one in the 19th century in civilized countries has abused and outraged the Jew more than Grant." All right, rabbis can use hyperbole on occasion. I'm sure I could think of one or two in the 19th century, even in civilized countries, who abused Jews more. Most Jews disagreed, and they voted for Grant anyway. And the best explanation for the travesty was one that Grant offered during the campaign, and that rings true. You know, years later, a Jew, Simon Wolfe, wrote that he had heard from Grant that it was really Sherman who issued the order, and Grant just signed it without thinking, without looking at it. Doesn't seem to be true, but Grant himself said during the campaign, I quote, "I do not pretend to sustain the order. At the time of its publication, I was incensed by a reprimand received from Washington for permitting acts which Jews within my lines were engaged in. The order was issued and sent without any reflection and without thinking of the Jews as a sect or race to themselves, but simply as persons who had successfully violated an order. I have no prejudice against any sect or race, but want each individual to be judged by his own merit." All right, it sounds true. What's the modern equivalent of that? You write a nasty email to someone, and then you hit send before you have a chance to reflect a little, to deliberate and think, should I really send this? That's what Grant did with his order also. You can read the whole account, by the way, in another book by Jonathan Sarna, entitled When General Grant Expelled the Jews. 14 months after the order, March 1864, Lincoln appointed Grant general of the army, top dog. One Lincoln ally who encouraged this was Joseph Seligman, who was a German Jew, started as a peddler, became a major banker and a supporter of Grant. But it's so interesting, the Jewish sources play up Seligman as instrumental in Grant's appointment. The biographies of Grant don't even mention him, so okay, you have to find the truth somewhere in the middle. Lincoln gave Grant full command, moving east. He had separate commands fighting in different parts of the South. Sherman was further south. And Grant confronted Lee in the Overland Campaign, late 64. Bloody,
but slowly weakening and degrading Lee's forces. Lee was running short on manpower and supplies. The southern economy was collapsing. March 1865, Grant captured Petersburg, Virginia, famous battle there. Visited that battlefield many years ago. Took the children, by the way, to see the battlefield. I'm not sure they remember it. A month later, Grant captured Richmond, the Confederate capital. Without the war, and for the most part, was effectively over. Grant accepted Lee's surrender at Appomattox, April 9, 1865, with grace and magnanimity. He had a view of reconciliation that matched Lincoln's. Another irony. He and Julia were invited by Abraham Lincoln to join Abe and Mary at Ford's Theater Friday night, April 14th, for the show. But Julia did not like Mary. Mary could be, she's mentally ill, but Mary could be imperious, and Mary was overly jealous of any woman who was in Lincoln's presence. So Julia said she wants to spend no time with that woman, and the afternoon of the 14th, they left town. Good choice. They weren't at the theater that night. Lincoln found another couple, engaged couple, one a major, and he suffered serious wounds during the assassination attempt. Grant was a national hero, but he disclaimed any interest in politics. He had the military discipline of integrity and service, and years later, he said he was shocked to come to Washington and see people acting in the petty private, their petty private interests and not for the sake of the people. But he was widely perceived as a person who could bring all factions together, unite the country and the strife, and let everyone enjoy the fruits of victory. So when Johnson stumbled badly and he tried to immunize himself by inserting Grant into Stanton's office because Grant was popular, that didn't end well. Grant resigned anyway, but Grant easily won the Republican nomination for president in 1868, and he defeated the Democrat New York governor Horatio Seymour 53-47%. Three southern states, still unreconstructed, were not allowed to vote. And Grant ran on one platform, four words. Not make America great again. Let us have peace. And that was it. And he was perceived as the only one who could do it. The nation was torn apart by the rise of various groups with colorful names, incompatible goals, copperheads, scalawags, carpetbaggers. That Grant failed is not necessarily attributable to him, I say at least, but to the intractability of slavery. And I'll give you an analogy. A little Torah? Why not? So Rav Yaakov Ariel, Ramat Gan, speaks Moshe Rabbeinu. So these are the subjects we're dealing with now, slavery in Egypt. So he wrote that Moshe Rabbeinu was a revolutionary because he was given an unprecedented task. What was Moshe asked to do? Everyone in the world accepted slavery, both masters and slaves. It was legitimate. It was normal. So in order to succeed, Moshe had to shatter the conventional wisdom. And he couldn't. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to intervene. By way of analogy, it was very similar in the South. Slavery was normal. Slavery was a way of life. It was the way of the world. That blacks were seen as inferior is the way of the world. And that's not going to change overnight. So the extent of Grant's failure to resolve all these issues has been debated for over 150 years now. Perhaps if he were a more astute politician, he could have succeeded. But he won election precisely because he was not a politician. And that too should ring bells for us. People were irritated with the political class. And Grant only ran when he realized that no one in the political class could accomplish anything. One biographer says of Grant that he took office amid what he called the politics of confrontation, in which Johnson and Congress agreed on nothing. So who says that Grant really could have changed anything, much less everything? And what was asked of Grant, in essence? He had a number of tasks. To protect southern blacks, conciliate southern whites, mollify northern whites, both those who wanted revenge against the South and those who wanted full and equal rights for blacks. Well, the bottom line is that trying to do all that is like trying to thread an elephant through a needle. Those objectives were collectively incompatible. So recently, some have looked at Grant more favorably. Who could have healed? What could have healed these rifts in American society? Only one thing: time. And it took about a century, took a few new generations. To an extent, you know, it's a big issue today again, racial unrest is still present in America, but for a different reason. Americans, and this I'm talking historically now, Americans came to accept equal treatment for blacks, but not preferential treatment. And the drive for equal rights became a drive for special rights, and that's where we are today. Anyone who opposes special rights is called a racist. Grant tried to form a balanced cabinet, and he pushed through Congress ratification of the 15th Amendment, which reads, in pertinent part, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude." Meaning, guaranteeing blacks now have the right to vote, at least in national elections, but by extension, if they're citizens, they could vote in local elections as well. And it was on the basis of the acceptance of the 15th Amendment that the last few southern states, the holdouts, were allowed formally to rejoin the Union and have representatives elected to Congress. And Grant also was not hesitant to use military force to protect the rights of all citizens, white or black, and he did it in the late 1860s to thwart the Ku Klux Klan, which was formed then again to persecute blacks in the South. But with the 15th Amendment, many whites felt that the work of Reconstruction was done. The future would be changed only through hearts and minds, not legislation, and the underlying tensions remained. Think about it like this. In some states, blacks were the majority of eligible voters because they now had the right to vote, and many whites refused to take the loyalty oath. That's why blacks went a long time without having representatives in Congress, but not after the Civil War. After the Civil War, there were a number of blacks who were senators and congressmen, and then it took about 100 years for that to happen again. It's because blacks became the majority of voters. And there are also scandals in which Grant was not involved that nonetheless reflected poorly on him because the guilty were his appointees. Grant remained popular, and he won re-election 1872 in a smashing victory, defeating Horace Greeley, the New York newspaper publisher, 56-44%, winning 31 out of 37 states. But everything went sour from then, primarily because of the panic of 1873, another cyclical economic collapse. The New York Stock Exchange stopped trading for 10 days, but the economy took years to recover. Businesses failed, unemployment rose, wages dropped, Grant had no answer, and he veered between conflicting advice, which always happens: do something or do nothing. Well, nothing worked. And because between the corruption of several cabinet members and advisors who were taking bribes, and the Depression, the bloom was off Grant's rose. He briefly contemplated running for a third term, but it was not to be. And when he left office, he deemed it a misfortune that he became president with no previous training. One thing is true: Grant tried to placate the Jews while he was in office, and he appointed many Jews to public positions, even more than Lincoln, and even intervened, as Buchanan had not, and Van Buren did, when Jews were attacked overseas. When Russia tried to expel 20,000 Jews in 1869, Grant lodged the protest. After a pogrom in Romania in 1870, Grant not only protested, but he appointed a Jew as consul in Bucharest to monitor the plight of the Jews there. One Benjamin Franklin Peixoto, who was the New York-born president of B'nai B'rith. In fact, B'nai B'rith paid his salary as to be the consul in Bucharest. And the truth is that while he served, there were fewer attacks on Jews, although in Romania, Jew hatred remained prevalent. In 1874, Grant became the first president to attend services at a synagogue, schlepping the entire cabinet to the dedication of Adath Israel in Washington, D.C. By 1870, there are 152 synagogues in the United States, serving more than 73,000 worshipers. The first rabbinical college, Maimonides College of Philadelphia, opened in 1867. By the 1870s began the period of real growth. By 1880, there were about 250,000 Jews in America. Immigration spiked, and there's one plausible reason for it. The many reasons are offered. I mentioned this in the Great Decision series a few years ago. This is Rabbi Rakefet. Jews in Europe, after the Civil War, became aware of just how different America was. The persecution was the same. The Pale of Settlement was the Pale of Settlement. Russia was Russia. Germany was Germany. The Tsar, the Kaiser, the Austro-Hungarian Emperor. They weren't changing. But now imagine a society that fought a war in order to free black slaves? That was unprecedented. That, you see, why leave the Tsar, the Kaiser, the Emperor to go to an unknown? You could be persecuted there too. You might as well stay where you are. But now they realize, no, that America really was different. They fought in order to free slaves. Such a country would not tolerate persecution of Jews. That was revolutionary. And when Jews realized that in such a country they have nothing to worry about, certainly not what they worried about under the tyrannies of the Tsar and the Kaiser and others, they began to flock to America. And that's when it started. Being less than 1% of the population of the South, Jews were not influential in the Reconstruction narrative. There were Jews among the carpetbaggers, of course. There were Jews who moved from the North to take advantage of the economic opportunities. And a few even became successful politicians in Louisiana by cultivating the black vote, one of those places where the blacks were the majority. After leaving office, Grant, Ulysses, and Julia embarked on a worldwide tour, first in Europe, and then in the early winter, 1878, they came to the land of Israel, what Grant called the Holy Land. He became the first president, even ex-president, to visit Yerushalayim, overwhelmed by it. Then he went to the Ottoman Empire and east to Japan and back across the Pacific. He returned home destitute. Remember, he was only a military man, and his only source of income, his army pension, had ended when he resigned his commission. As long as you remained an active member, you received your pension, otherwise not. Back then, Congress refused to pass a law restoring Grant's pension. Why? Because Grant had brought the South back into Congress. Notwithstanding the loyalty oath, it was filled with Confederates who hated Grant, so they basically voted for his poverty. He tried and failed to get the nomination in 1880, and he was broke. He moved to New York City. He lived in an apartment that was purchased for him by supporters. And for money, he decided to write his memoirs. I think Quincy Adams had done the same. But it turned out to be an excellent book. And Grant got a $10,000 advance plus royalties, a deal negotiated with his own publisher by Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain. Grant completed the book, as this was serendipity, just 5 days before he died of throat cancer in 1882, age 63. But in the preceding years, Congress had restored his pension because Grant was reappointed General of the Army and his book was a bestseller. So he died, leaving Julia some money. His last word, water, which makes sense. Now, Grant's reputation has fluctuated wildly since his term. The Jews made peace with him, but his historians still argue as to how good a president he was. And the range is from good to awful. In the polls, you see he's as high as 18 and as low as 38. Few presidents have such a range, but Grant always remained popular with the people. And that's why his portrait has adorned the $50 bill since 1913. More than 1 million people attended his funeral. He was first buried in Central Park. And then Grant's tomb along Riverside Drive was erected by President McKinley in 1897. Remember, McKinley had served under Grant during the war. Grant, of course, is not buried there. Hey, old joke. He's not buried. Buried means to be below ground. He's actually entombed in a mausoleum above ground. So if you ask, who's burying Grant's tomb, it's an unknown. Now what he failed to do, like most, like so many other politicians, was unite a divided country. This would result in one of the most bitterly contested elections ever, the election of 1876, where for one of the few times in American history, the winner of the popular vote was not elected president. What happened and what the Jews of the time were doing, we will discuss next week. Next week, we'll look at, again, three presidents, the presidencies of Rutherford B. Hayes, James Garfield, and Chester A. Arthur. I thank you all very much. Sure, thank you.